We have some questions, and if those of you have questions, please use the question cards, and we can continue to circulate and pick up questions for both Bob and Peter. So I'd like to start with... The first question is for Bob Galvin, and the question is, how do you bridge the technology divide between the haves and the have-nots using the Scottish model?
The Scottish model is built around enlightenment. Enlightenment is a way of thinking, free, open, objective, rational. And the first thing that we've got to do in terms of bridging is to have an ability to understand each other, language or otherwise. The Scots, incidentally, spent a lot of time on rhetoric to get things done. There has to be literacy for the technologies to be readily transferred. A generation earlier than Peter, colleagues of mine, some of whom are sitting in this room, took technology to the first order of receiving nations who could accept the technology. They are flourishing today. So there has to be an enlightenment with regard to education and literacy so that those to whom we will carry our investments and our services can pick up and do what is clearly understandable, but you have to have the base to understand.
Is there anything you'd want to add to that, Peter?
No, all good.
The next question is, how can the lessons of the Scottish forefathers be applied to America today, particularly regarding globalization?
The theses of Adam Smith and David Hume in particular are as enlightened and applicable to today's thinking as they were in training people on an introductory basis of what those principles were back in the late 1700s. So, frankly, just studying the Scottish Enlightenment, studying what the Scots have done, there are incidentally a lot of marvelous books on the Scots of how they have taken their try-to and to-do philosophy and character and have gone about and have seeded great success throughout the world. So role models are there to be copied.
Next question is, how do you see the future, the present and future competitive position of the U.S. semiconductor companies?
You can pick up on any of these you want.
Well, that would be your area of expertise. I'll take that one.
There are about 10 or 15 sage semiconductor leaders, executives, technologists in this audience. Maybe I am underestimating the number of outstanding people. I cannot imagine that the United States will ever be less than the equal of the best in the creation of the semiconductor recipes for product development throughout the world. Among the things that are represented in this room are those who had to do with the establishment of an organization called Semitech. Its distinguished leader is sitting among us, among others. And we taught ourselves in that organization how to get better at what we were doing rather well. The American spirit is such that it will always do things of that nature as well as individual and independent activities. I see America as being a continuing equal of the best, often moving ahead to the best. Thank goodness there is remarkable competition in two or three other nations of the world that will keep us on our toes.
The USA has to maintain leadership in the global economy. What is your take on outsourcing?
I think that certainly the Adam Smith line that comes to mind is that no country has ever done well that was endowed with great harbors, and that chose to throw rocks in them and prevent people from importing and sending things to them. So, and very much the same thing I think that is true of free trade applies to the free movement of labor. There are a lot of internal challenges with outsourcing. There are people who are going to be displaced, but the reality is that if you don't do it, it's much worse. If the U.S. is to remain competitive, we need to be able to outsource. And the U.S. needs to focus on doing things better in other ways, and needs to see this as a challenge for us to get better at doing things rather than an obstacle. You don't become better if you have great harbors by throwing rocks in them and preventing people from importing things. I think Smith was right about that.
I would coin a phrase, and that would be resourcing. That's different than the resources that are property-based things. The resourcing. The nature of the world is that whatever was the source today moves to a different location tomorrow. We used to have most of our industry in New England. It moved to the Midwest. It moved to the South. It was always dislocating to the location left behind. But then let me quickly turn the subject into one that was literally a part of what Peter was talking about, and that is, what do the governments do? Fortunately, we have a constitution. The constitution is the main law of the land. And I respectfully suggest that what you are going to be learning of, you may know it, but what the world is going to be learning of, is that anything that one does to attempt to artificially control sourcing will prove to be unconstitutional. No state can pass any law that will stand with our Constitution that penalizes someone who does outsourcing. That's interfering with international relations. You can't do that under our Constitution. We aren't going to be able to do it in relation to other world laws either. It is unconstitutional to worry about it. It's going to happen. And that hasn't surfaced, but I respectfully suggest watch for it. That will become a very major player in finally settling things down and getting people to realize we got to do what Peter has talked about. We got to go out there and compete. And incidentally, one of the things that is occurring and will occur in a greater with greater frequency is the bringing of jobs back, bringing of jobs into the United States from those institutions outside of the United States who have the resources to invest in our country and will come and put new peoples into work on new subjects. So this is going to balance itself out.
Yeah, some of you may have seen some of the news reports. It turns out that last year China on net outsourced more than any other country to India, which is an interesting statistic. The next question is, I understand that you were involved in trade negotiations that resulted in making the commercial internet feasible. Is this true? And if so, can you recount this saga?
That
would have to be you, Peter.
I wasn't. I was neither. So.
Okay.
I think neither of us invented the internet.
In reference to the Scottish Enlightenment, how do you combine your spiritual practice with your professional practice?
The premise that the Scottish Enlightenment represents, in effect, almost a theology of some kind, and then our regular practice, I can't quite derive the genesis of the question, but I do acknowledge that in the course of the Scots becoming the very talented people that they became in that ultimate generation in around 1750, they got there as a function of having been viciously tested by the religious Reformation. The Calvinist thesis of predetermination was beginning to challenge men's ability to think. Every church in Scotland attempted to teach a greater fear of God, the wrath of God, than the other. And the fact of the matter is that the religious movement that took place in the period of time of roughly the 1600s, John Knox was living in the 1500s, but in the 1600s and the 1700s provided a stressful effervescence that made for a remarkable emergence of other intellectual as well as theological thinkings that made a difference. I haven't applied that to an individual, but it had a marked impact on causing that which was the Scottish Enlightenment was better than it would have been, than it could possibly have been if it had not been stressed by the religious Reformation.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things I would underscore is that while there are some definite differences between my perspective and Bob's, one thing that I very much agree with is that in the late 18th century, the Enlightenment direction was the only rational direction that people could possibly go in. I think the historical context was one where in the early 17th century, you had seen Europe almost destroy itself in the wars of religion, and there had to be some sort of ability to try to take a step back from that and try to figure out some slightly different basis on which people could work together and get along. And so I think there was a historical context, the preceding 100-150 years, that really, for the late 18th century, made the Enlightenment the only possible direction, at least for that point in time.
The next question is, Adam Smith critiqued government privileges and proposed the abolition of so-called mercantilism. Would you describe the U.S. today as neo-mercantilist? Or in that direction, I guess, that's what he's saying.
I really don't know. I know that what the private enterpriser is doing. I know what the Peters are doing. I know some of you who are in your businesses now. I know what we did and my colleagues that are continuing in our institution are doing. I think that we are not, in this instance, struggling with a philosophy. I think we're dealing with a very wonderful principle, and that is that commerce is the way to afford a free society. Then you have to have the structuring of and the ingraining of principles in that free society, and that what those who are engaged in commercialization have to realize is that their great contribution to society is to make affordable everything else in society. And we have to do that by playing to the whole market We call it global, and we're learning how to do that. The Peters have learned a lot about it, and my colleagues in other of our tables at these room in this room, we're learning about it. So I don't know what to call it, but I do know that it's very simple that we have to create wealth wherever we can honorably do it, and that wealth will ultimately end up being reasonably shared by those who have the literacy to participate with us in a civilized way.
I basically agree with that. I think fundamentally, mercantilism does not make sense. At the same time, I think it's actually a close call politically in terms of what's happening. I think if you look at the electoral breakdown of people in the U.S. Congress, we probably have it's probably a slightly pro-protectionist bias. It's probably more protection than it has been at any time, I would guess, in about close to 20 years. So I think the case that Bob is making needs to be made a lot more forcefully than it has been.
Two last questions. This one's a little off the subject of the Enlightenment. This is a question for Peter. Please name and describe some of the stranger internet company ideas you come across.
Oh my. I don't want to, this would be sort of a long litany of things. I think one of the strange dynamics that happened culturally was that that you basically had all these incredible new businesses that were being built in Silicon Valley, and elsewhere in the world people were trying to copy Silicon Valley and do something similar, and what they copied was often not the entrepreneurial or the innovative piece, but the piece that was strange or different. And so you ended up in many places with companies that tried to simply copy the most bizarre features because they thought that was what was the defining piece of the new economy. So the strangest ones I actually ran into were outside the United States. There was one of the, the PayPal originally was combined with this company called X.com, which ran itself around a single letter name. And there was a company I ran into in France, got about 100 million euros in funding, so it was a significantly funded company, and they decided to brand themselves to copy that and to use a single letter. That they thought that was the most important thing. Nothing about the product or anything like that, just the single letter. And in Paris, and they called themselves Z Bank, and so they used the letter Z. And everything was about doing a bank in a way that was different from the way it was normally done. The front page website had cartoon chimpanzees holding bags of money. It was meant to be a bank that did not take itself or your money too seriously. Indeed, the name itself was designed to basically make fun of French people. So it was about the bank, sort of make fun of pretentious French people, and so on down the line. On every detail, they were going to do everything differently. So it was basically, there was a 35-hour maximum work week in France. Well, we will compete and we will attract people who do not want to work that long, so we're going to have a shorter work week than 35 hours. And so that was the mantra. And I think the takeaway, sort of on a higher level, is that when you look at businesses, one of the important questions is what kind of a role model you choose, and who is it that you want to copy? Who is it that you want to emulate? And it's not just who you're emulating, but it's even on a somewhat more detailed level as to what exactly it is that one is emulating. And there's no probably categorical answer to that, but it's a fairly important question. At the tail end of the boom, it went very badly wrong, where people copied crazy things that other people were copying crazily from other people in turn, and it just sort of veered in really bizarre directions.
Okay, last question. Speaking of the French, the question is, please comment on the connection in thought between Frederick Bastiat and the Scottish Reformation. I assume he's talking about the Scottish Enlightenment, and I suspect this also relates to say and other French liberal economists.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the beginning item that is supposed to be compared with the rest.
Please comment on the connection in thought between Frederick Bastiat and the Scottish Enlightenment.
I don't know what the factors were of the first, and therefore I am not credentialed to answer the question. I'm sorry, I can't. Okay. I don't understand the question, and therefore I can't comment. I'm sorry.
The Bastiat was a member of the French Parliament and was an economist who wrote various books. And there was a whole French classical liberal tradition. It's an interesting comparison because the English would not read the French. And so in many respects, they developed separately. And even to this day, most Americans aren't aware. In fact, most French are not aware of this tradition. I hope all of you will get a chance to read Bob's book because it is a quick read, as Bob mentioned. It's a book that I recommend to anyone who is busy. But the reason why we're here is not just to talk about Bob's book. The reason we're here is because we greatly appreciate and admire Bob Galvin for a career that has been exemplary in every aspect of his life, which has been quite diverse. So Bob, all of us want to thank you sincerely for this work. And to express our gratitude, I want to take this opportunity to present you with an award the Independent Institute only gives occasionally. We've only given it to four other people over 18 years. As Dan Edelman mentioned, it's named after the 19th century classical liberal Alexis de Tocqueville. In your gift bag, you'll find a one-page sheet description of de Tocqueville and his work. And as Dan Edelman mentioned, de Tocqueville is the author of perhaps the greatest book ever written on liberty called Democracy in America. Hence, In deep appreciation and recognition of your outstanding global contributions in advancing business excellence, free market entrepreneurship, education, moral principles, economic and social welfare, and your unwavering dedication to the principles of individual liberty as the foundations of free and humane societies, we proudly present to you the Alexis de Tocqueville Award. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for your kindness, generosity, and participation in making our dinner possible tonight. I want to thank again all the people who made the dinner possible on the committee, who were co-chairs, who donated, and so forth. We look forward to the opportunity and your participation in future programs of the Independent Institute. Thank you so much, and good night.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
All right, one more.
Hi. Hello.
Ben Collins, San Jose State University.
Okay. It's great.